Interview with the Onion AV Club by Keith Phipps. Quote, I think the idea of art kills creativity, end quote. DNA. The Onion. You've got a lot of stuff going on. What do you want to talk about first? Douglas Adams. I guess there are two main things. One is that we are imminently about to finish this thing that I've been labouring over for what seems like 2 years now, called Starship Titanic, which is a CD-ROM. It's coming out in a couple months' time. The other thing is that I've just agreed to the sale of Hitchhiker's Guide to Disney. So I guess over the next couple of years, that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm making that movie. Onion. Tell me about Starship Titanic. Douglas. Well, it's a CD-ROM, and the most important thing is that it started as a CD-ROM. People wanted me to do a CD-ROM of Hitchhikers, and I thought, no, no. I didn't want to just sort of reverse-engineer yet another thing from a book I'd already written. I think that the digital media are interesting enough in their own right to be worth originating something in. Because really, the moment you have any idea, the second thought that enters your mind after the original idea is, what is this? Is it a book? Is it a movie? Is it a this? Is it a that? Is it a short story? Is it a breakfast cereal? Really, from that moment, your decision about what kind of thing it is then determines how it develops. So something will be very, very different if it's developed as a CD-ROM than if it's developed as a book. Now, in fact, I tell a slight lie, because the idea as such, in a sort of single-paragraph form, actually was what it was in one of the Hitchhiker books. I think Life, the Universe and Everything. Because whenever I'd get sort of stuck on a storyline in Hitchhiker, I'd always invent a couple of other quick storylines and give them to the guide to talk about. So here was one little idea that was sitting there, and a number of people said to me, "Oh, you should turn that into a novel." It just seemed like too much of a good idea, and I tend to resist those. But in fact, I discovered there was a very good reason why I wasn't interested in doing Starship Titanic as a book, which was that essentially it was a story about a thing. I just thought of this idea, and didn't have any people attached to it, and you can only really tell stories about people. So later, when I was thinking, OK, now I want to do a CD-ROM, because I want to justify the fact that I spend all my time sitting fiddling around with computers, I actually wanted to turn it into proper grown-up work. So I was thinking, what would be a good thing? Then I suddenly remembered that the problem with turning Starship Titanic into a book, that it was about a thing, about a place, about a ship, suddenly became very much to its advantage. When you're doing a CD-ROM, what you're eventually going to create is a place, an environment. The Onion. And the user becomes the character. Douglas. Yes, exactly. Once the place begins to develop, you then put the characters in it. But it isn't about the characters, it's about the ship. What I then wanted to do was something, well, it was either very old-fashioned or very radical, depending on which way you look at it. I wanted to build a conversation engine into the game. Years and years ago, I did a game based on Hitchhiker's Guide with a company called Infocom, which was a great company. They were doing witty, intelligent, literate games based on text. You know, there are several thousand years of human culture telling you can do quite a lot with text, and putting in the extra element of interactivity should just add to the possibilities. You turn the computer into the storyteller and the player into the audience, like in the old days when the storyteller would actually respond to the audience rather than just have the audience respond to the storyteller. I had an enormous amount of fun, actually, working on that. I just loved constructing these virtual conversations between the player and the machine. So I just thought it'd be lovely to try to extend that and do more with it in a modern graphics game. Because what I would like to do is see if one can take that old conversation technology and make characters really speak. Put them in an environment and see where you go from there. So we started to tackle this problem of being able to speak to the characters. Of course, everything you do with language just balloons as a problem. To begin with, we wanted to do it whereby it would be text-to-speech, which gives you the advantage that you have much more flexibility in constructing sentences on the fly. On the other hand, all of your characters sound like semi-concussed Norwegians, which I felt is a downside. So we eventually realised we were going to have to do pre-recorded speech. And I thought, that's terrible, because you only have a limited number of responses. It's just going to be... Oh, I'm not sure about that. So the way we eventually solved the problem, or gradually solved the problem, was that the amount of pre-recorded speech just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. We just did another 2-hour recording session this morning. We've now got something like 16 hours of little conversational snippets, little phrases, sentences, half-sentences, and all the things the machine puts together on the fly in response to what you type in. For a long time, it wasn't working very well, It was stupid, and they didn't understand what the fuck it was saying. And now, just really in the last 2 or 3 weeks, it started to come together, and it started to be spooky. People come in and say, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, I don't see how this is going to work. How about if you ask it this?" And they do, and their jaw drops. It's just wonderful. People come in and spend hours just sitting, locked in conversation with these characters. I hasten to add that with the 16 hours of dialogue, it was a small team of us who wrote it. I did part of the dialogue writing, and other people did some, and we all pulled it together. It's pretty remarkable when it works. You suddenly have this populated world. Very strange, damaged robots crawling around the place, all of whom have a wide range of opinions and attitudes and ideas and strange histories, and know about some entirely unexpected things. You can engage them all in conversation. The Onion. Do you feel concerned that after all this work, people won't treat it with the gravity of, say, a movie or a book? That they won't treat it as an art form? Douglas. I hope that's the case, yes. I get very worried about this idea of art. I've been trying to... Having been an English literary graduate, I've been trying to avoid the idea of doing art ever since. I think the idea of art kills creativity. That was one of the reasons I really wanted to go and do a CD-ROM, because nobody will take it seriously, and therefore you can sneak under the fence with lots of good stuff. It's funny how often it happens. I guess when the novel started, most early novels were just sort of pornography. Apparently most media actually started as pornography and sort of grew from there. This is not a pornographic CD-ROM, I hasten to add. Before 1962, everybody thought pop music was sort of... Nobody would have ever remotely called it art. And then somebody comes along and is just so incredibly creative in it, just because they love it to bits and think it's the greatest fun you can possibly have. And within a few years you've got Sergeant Pepper's and so on, and everybody's calling it art. I think media are at their most interesting before anybody's thought of calling them art, when people still think they're just a load of junk. The Onion. But say, 20 years from now, would you like to be recognised as one of the earliest practitioners of CD-ROM as art? Douglas. Well, I would just like a lot of people to have bought it. One, for the extremely obvious reason, but the other is that if it's popular and people really like it and have fun with it, you feel you've done a good job. And if somebody wants to come along and say, "Oh, it's art," well, that's as it may be. I really don't mind that much, but I think that's for other people to decide after the fact. It isn't what you should be aiming to do. There's nothing worse than sitting down to write a novel and saying, "Well, okay, I'm going to do something of high artistic worth." It's funny. I read something the other day, just out of absolute curiosity. I read Thunderball, which is one of the James Bond books that I would love to have read when I was, I don't know, about 14, just sort of thumbing through it for the bits where he puts his left hand on her breast and saying, "Oh my God, how exciting." But I just thought, well, James Bond has become such an icon in our pop culture in the last 40 years, it would be interesting to see what it actually was like. And what prompted me to do this, apart from the fact that I happened to find a copy lying around, was reading someone talking about Ian Fleming and saying that he had aimed not to be literary, but to be literate, which is a very, very big and crucial difference. So I thought, well, I'll see if he managed to do that. It's interesting, because it was actually very well written as a piece of craft. He knew how to use the language, he knew how to make it work, and he wrote well. But obviously nobody would call it literature. But I think you get most of the most interesting work done in fields where people don't think they're doing art, but are merely practicing a craft and working as good craftsmen. Being literate as a writer is good craft, is knowing your job, is knowing how to use your tools properly and not to damage the tools as you use them. I find when I read literary novels, you know, with a capital L, I think an awful lot is nonsense. If I want to know something interesting about a way human beings work, how they relate to each other and how they behave, I'll find an awful lot of women crime novelists who do it better. Ruth Rendell, for instance. If I want to read something that's really giving me something serious and fundamental to think about the human condition, if you like, or what we're all doing here or what's going on, then I'd rather read something by a scientist in the life sciences, like Richard Dawkins, for instance. I feel that the agenda of life's important issues has moved from novelists to science writers, because they know more. I tend to get very suspicious of anything that thinks it's art while it's being created. As far as being a CD-ROM is concerned, I just wanted to do the best thing I could and have as much fun as I could doing it. I think it's pretty good. There are always bits that you fret over for being less than perfect, but you can't keep on worrying over something forever. The thing is pretty damn good. The Onion. You've got the movie, too. I'd heard rumours of a Hitchhiker's Guide movie kicking around for decades. Douglas. Oh, well, yeah. Although it sort of bubbles under, there have been two previous sources of rumours. One was when I originally sold the rights about 15 years ago to Ivan Reitman, who was not as well known then as he is now. It really didn't work out, because once we got down to it, Ivan and I didn't really see eye to eye. In fact, it turned out he hadn't actually read the book before he bought it. He'd merely read the sales figures. I think it really wasn't his cup of tea, so he wanted to make something rather different. Eventually, we agreed to differ and went our respective ways, and by this time, the ownership had passed from him to Columbia, and he went on to make a movie called Ghostbusters, so you can imagine how irritated I was by that. It sat there, owned by Columbia, for many years. I think Ivan Reitman then got somebody else to write a script based on it, which is, I think, the worst script I'd ever read. Unfortunately, it has my name on it, and the other writers, whereas I did not contribute a single comma to it. I've only just discovered that that script has been sitting in Script City, or wherever it is, for a long time, and that everyone assumes I wrote it, and am therefore a terrible screenwriter, which is rather distressing to me. So then, a few years ago, I was introduced to someone who became a great friend of mine called Michael Nesmith, who has done a number of different things in his career. In addition to being a film producer, he was originally one of the Monkees, which is kind of odd when you get to know him, because he's such a serious, thoughtful, quiet chap, but with quiet reserves of impish glee. So his proposal was that we go into partnership together to make this. He's the producer, and I do the scripts and so on. We had a very good time working on it for quite a while, but I just think Hollywood at that point saw the thing as old. It's been around the block. And basically, what I was being told an awful lot was essentially, science fiction comedy will not work as a movie, and here's why not. If it could work, somebody would have done it already. The Onion. That logic seems kind of flawed. Douglas. So what happens, of course, is that Men in Black came out this past year, so suddenly somebody has done it already. And Men in Black is... How can I put this delicately? There were elements of it I found quite familiar, shall we say. And suddenly a comedy science fiction movie that was very much in the same vein as Hitchhiker's became one of the most successful movies ever made. So that kind of changed the landscape a little bit. Suddenly people kind of wanted it. The project with Michael... In the end, we hadn't gotten it to take, so we parted company, very good friends, and still are. I just hope that there will be other projects in the future that he and I will work on together, because I like him enormously, and we got on very well together. And also, the more time I get to spend in Santa Fe, the better. So now the picture's with Disney, or more specifically with Caravan, which is one of the major independent production companies, but it's kind of joined at the hip to Disney. It's been very frustrating not to have made it in the last 15 years. Nevertheless, I feel extremely buoyed by the fact that one can make a much, much, much better movie out of it now than one could have 15 years ago. That's in technical terms, in terms of how it will look and how it will work. Obviously, the real quality of the picture is in the writing and the acting and the directing and so on and so forth, and those skills have neither risen nor sunk in 15 years, but at least one substantial area in how it can be made to look has improved a great deal. The Onion. And Jay Roach, who directed Austin Powers, is directing it, right? Douglas. That's right. He's a very interesting fellow. I've now spent quite a lot of time talking to him. The key to the whole thing, in many ways, was when I met Jay Roach, because I hit it off very well with him and thought, here's a very bright, intelligent guy. Not only is he a bright, intelligent guy, but here's a measure of how bright and intelligent he is. He wants me to work very closely on his movie. Which is always something that endears a writer to a director. In fact, when I was making the original radio series, it was unheard of to do what I did, because I'd just written it. But I kind of inserted myself in the whole production process. The producer-director was a little surprised by this, but in the end took it in very good grace. So I had a huge amount to do with the way the program developed, and that's exactly what Jay wants me to do on this movie. So I felt, great, here's somebody I can do business with. Obviously, I'm saying that at the beginning of a process that's going to take 2 years, so who knows what's going to happen. All I can say is that at this point in the game, things are set as fair as they possibly could be, so I feel very optimistic and excited about that. The Onion. It's been nearly 20 years since the radio program, right? Douglas. Well, it's almost 20 years. It'll be 20 years next month. The Onion. What's the enduring appeal of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Douglas. Well, I don't know. All I know is that I worked very hard at it, and I worried very much about it, and I think I made things very difficult for myself doing it. And if ever there was an easy way of doing something, I would find a much harder way to do it. And I suspect that the amount that people have found in it is not unrelated to the amount of work I put into it. That's a simplistic thing to say, but that's the best I can come up with. The Onion. Is the idea that the movie will cover the first book? Douglas. Yeah, it's funny, because I've been looking around the web at what people have been saying. I've seen, he's going to put all five books into it. People just don't understand the way a book maps onto a movie. Somebody said, and I think quite accurately, that the best source material for a movie is a short story, which effectively means, yes, it's going to be the first book. Having said that, whenever I sit down and do another version of Hitchhikers, it highly contradicts whichever version went before. The best thing I can say about the movie is that it will be specifically contradicting the first book. The Onion. Which version of Hitchhiker are you happiest with? Douglas. Not the TV version, that's for sure. In different moods, I will feel either the radio or the book, which are the two other versions left, so it's got to be one of those, hasn't it? I feel differently about each of them. On the one hand, the radio series was where it originated. That's where it grew. That's where the seed grew. Also, that's where I felt that myself and the other people working on it, the producer and the sound engineers and so on, and of course the actors, all created something that really felt groundbreaking at the time. Or rather, it felt like we were completely mad at the time. I can remember sitting in the subterranean studio auditioning the sound of a whale hitting the ground at 300 miles an hour for hours on end, just trying to find ways of tweaking the sound. After hours of that, day after day, you do begin to doubt your sanity. Of course, you have no idea if anybody's going to listen to this stuff. But you know, there was a real sense that nobody had done this before, and that was great. There's a great charge that comes with that. On the other hand, the appeal of the books to me is that it's just me. The real appeal of a book to any writer is that it is just them. That's it. There's nobody else involved. That's not quite true, of course, because the thing developed out of a radio series in the first place, and there is a sense in there of all the people who have contributed in one way or another to the radio show that it grew out of. But nevertheless, there is a this-is-all-my-own-work feel about the book, and I'm pleased with the way it reads. I feel it flows nicely. It feels as if it were easy to write, and I know how difficult that was to achieve. The Onion. Do you ever get tired of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Douglas. There was a period when I got heartily sick of it, and I really never wanted to hear anything more about it again, and I would almost scream at anybody who used the words to me. But since then, I went off and did other things. I did the Dirk Gently books. My favourite thing that I've ever done was a thing I did about 10 years ago. I went around the world with a zoologist friend of mine and looked for various rare and endangered species of animals and wrote a book about that called Last Chance to See, which is my own personal favourite. Hitchhiker now is something from the past that I feel very fond of. It was great, it was terrific, and it's been very good to me. I had a conversation a little while ago with Pete Townsend of The Who, and I think at that point I was saying, oh God, I hope I'm not just remembered as the person who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And he kind of reprimanded me a little bit. He said, look, I have the same thing with Tommy, and for a while I thought like that. The thing is, when you've got something like that in your history, it opens an awful lot of doors. It allows you to do a lot of other things. People remember that. It's something one should be grateful for. And I thought that was quite right. The Onion. Have you put Dirk Gently aside? Douglas. Well, I started to write another Dirk Gently book, and I just lost it. For some reason, I couldn't get it going, so I had to put it aside. I didn't know what to do with it. I looked at the material again about a year later and suddenly thought, actually, the reason is that the ideas and the character don't match. I've tried to go for the wrong kind of ideas, and these ideas would actually fit much better in a Hitchhiker book. But I don't want to write another Hitchhiker book at the moment, so I sort of put them on one side. And maybe one day I will write another Hitchhiker book, because there's an awful lot of material sitting round waiting to go in it. Another reason is that the last one, Mostly Harmless, is a very bleak book. People have tried to read all sorts of complicated reasons into it, and the reason was that I just had a lousy year. Just for all sorts of personal reasons, from a terrible death in the family to every kind of area, whether it was personal or professional, had just gone sour on me against a background in which I had to write a funny book, which turned out not to be very funny. So I'd quite like to maybe do another Hitchhiker book that sort of perks up the tone again. But going back to Dirk Gently, I sort of put Dirk aside, really. There was a student production of Dirk Gently in Oxford 2 or 3 months ago, so I went along to see it. And it's an enormously complicated plot. Part of the complexity is there to disguise the fact that the plot doesn't really work. It was funny watching it on stage because I suddenly began to think about it again and think, well, they did this well, but what they should have done was this, and they should have done that. You know, it starts the whole ball rolling in your head. What was also interesting to me was that while I was sitting there being quite critical of the production, I was astonished by how much the audience was enjoying it. It was rather sort of a peculiar situation. I suddenly thought, I would love to see this happen as a film, because I can now see, having thought about it freshly in this context, what kind of a movie it could be, and it could be great. So maybe, once the Hitchhiker movie has gotten to the stage where I can turn my attention to other things as well, that's what I'd like to do next. And hopefully, with that movie underway, I hope more doors will open as far as filmmaking is concerned. I would love to do movies, but this is a man saying this innocently, who's never done one. 1998. From Douglas Adams, 22 Duncan Terrace, London, N1, HBS. April 14th, 1999. To David Vogel, Walt Disney Pictures. Dear David, I've tried to reach you by phone a couple of times. Perhaps it would have helped if I'd explained why I was calling. I was in the States for a few days and thought it might be helpful if I came across to L.A. so that you and I could have a meeting. I didn't hear from you, so I'm on a plane back to England, where I'm typing this. We seem to have gotten to a place where the problems appear to loom larger than the opportunities. I don't know if I'm right in thinking this, but I only have silence to go on, which is always a poor source of information. It seems to me that we can either slip into the traditional stereotypes, you're the studio executive who has a million real-world problems to worry about, and I'm the writer who only cares about seeing his vision realized and hang the cost and consequences, or we can recognize that we both share the same goal, which is to make the most successful movie we possibly can. The fact that we may have different perspectives on how this can best be achieved should be a fertile source of debate and iterative problem-solving. It's not clear to me that a one-way traffic of written notes interspersed with long, dreadful silences is a good substitute for this. You have a great deal of experience nursing major motion pictures into existence. I have a great deal of experience of nursing The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy into existence in every other medium other than motion pictures. I'm sure you must feel frustrated that I don't seem to understand the range of problems you have to contend with, just as I feel frustrated that I haven't had any real creative dialogue with Disney about this project yet. I have a suggestion to make. Why don't we actually meet and have a chat? I could be in L.A. for next Monday, 4:19, or early the following week. I would invite Disney to bear the cost of this extra trip over. I've appended a list of numbers you can reach me on. If you manage not to reach me, I shall know you're trying not to. If you manage not to reach me, I shall know you're trying not to. Very, very hard indeed. Best wishes, Douglas Adams. The Private Life of Genghis Khan. Based on an original sketch by Douglas Adams and Graham Chapman. The last of the horsemen disappeared into the smoke, and the thudding of their hooves receded into the grey distance. The smoke hung on the land. It drifted across the setting sun, which lay like an open wound across the western sky. In the ringing silence that followed the battle, very, very few, pitifully few cries could be heard from the bloody, mangled wreckage on the fields. Ghost-like figures, stunned with horror, emerged from the woods, stumbled and then ran forward, crying. Women searching for their husbands, brothers, fathers, lovers, first amongst the dying and then amongst the dead. The flickering light by which they searched was that of their burning village, which had, that afternoon, officially become part of the Mongol Empire. The Mongols. From out of the wastes of Central Asia they had swept, a savage force for which the world was utterly unprepared. They swept like a wildly wielded scythe, hacking, slashing, obliterating all that lay in their path, and calling it conquest. And throughout the lands that feared them now, or would come to fear them, no name inspired more terror than that of their leader, Genghis Khan. The greatest of the Asian warlords, he stood alone, revered as a god among warriors, marked out by the cold light of his grey-green eyes, the savage furrow of his brow, and the fact that he could beat the shit out of any of them. Later that night, the moon rose, and by its light a small party of horsemen carrying torches rode quietly out from the Mongol encampment that sprawled over a nearby hill. A casual observer would not have noticed anything remarkable about the man who rode at their center, muffled in a heavy cloak, tense, hunched forward on his horse as if weighed down by a heavy burden, because a casual observer would have been dead. The band rode a few miles through the moonlit woods, picking their way along the paths until they came at last to a small clearing, and here they reined their horses in and waited on their leader. He moved his horse slowly forward and surveyed the small group of peasant huts that stood huddled together in the centre of the clearing, trying very hard at short notice to look deserted. Hardly any smoke at all was rising from the primitive chimney stacks. Virtually no light appeared at the windows, and not a sound could be heard from any of them save that of a small child saying, "Shh!" For a moment a strange green fire seemed to flash from the eyes of the Mongol leader. A heavy, deadly kind of a thing that you could hardly call a smile drew itself through his fine, wispy beard. The strange kind of smiley thing would signify, briefly, to anyone who was stupid enough to look, that there was nothing a Mongol warlord liked better after a day hacking people to bits than a big night out. The door flew open. A Mongol warrior surged into the hut like a savage wind. Two children ran screaming to their mother, who was cowering wide-eyed in the corner of the tiny room. A dog yelped. The warrior hurled his torch onto the still glowing fire, and then threw the dog onto it. That would teach it to be a dog. The last surviving man of the family, a grey and aged grandfather, stepped bravely forward, eyes flashing. With a flash of his sword, the Mongol whipped off the old man's head, which trundled across the floor and fetched up, leaning rakishly against a table leg. The old man's body stood tensely for a moment, not knowing what to think, as it began slowly, majestically, to topple forward. Khan strode in and pushed it brusquely aside. He surveyed the happy domestic scene and bestowed a grim kind of smile on it. Then he walked over to a large chair and sat in it, testing it first for comfort. When he was satisfied with it, he heaved a heavy sigh and sat back in front of the fire, on which the dog was now blazing merrily. The warrior grabbed at the terrified woman, pushed her children roughly aside, and brought her trembling in front of the mighty Khan. She was young and pretty, with long, bedraggled black hair. Her bosom heaved, and her face was stark with fright. Khan regarded her with a slow, contemptuous look. "Does she know," he said at length in a low, dead voice, "who I am?"
You are the mighty Khan," cried the woman.
Khan's eyes fixed themselves on hers. "Does she know," he hissed, "what I want of her?"
I'll do anything for you, O Khan," stammered the woman, "but spare my children."
Khan said quietly, "Then begin." His eyes dropped and he gazed distantly into the fire. Nervously, shaking with fear, the woman stepped forward and laid a tentative pale hand on Khan's arm. The soldier smacked her hand away. "Not that," he barked. The woman started back, a flutter. She realized she would have to do better. Still shaking, she knelt down on the floor and started gently to push apart the Khan's knees. "Stop that," roared the soldier, and shoved her violently backwards. Bewilderment began to mix with the terror in her eyes as she cowered on the floor. "Come on," snapped the soldier. "Ask him what kind of day he's had."
"What?" she wailed. I don't understand what—"
The soldier seized her, span her into a half-Nelson, and jabbed the point of his sword against her throat.
"I said, ask him," he hissed, "what kind of day he's had."
The woman gasped with pain and incomprehension. The sword jabbed again.
"Say it."
What sort of, day,"
she said in a hesitant, strangled squeak,
"have you had?"
"Dear," hissed the soldier. "Say, dear."
Her eyes bulged in horror at the sword.
"What sort of day have you had, dear?" she asked querulously.
Khan looked up, briefly, wearily.
"Oh, same as usual," he said. "Violent."
He gazed back at the fire again.
"Right," said the soldier to the woman. "Go on."
She relaxed very slightly. She seemed to have passed some kind of test. Perhaps it would be straightforward from now on, and she could at least get it over with. She moved nervously forward and started to caress the Khan again. The soldier hurled her savagely across the room, kicked her and yanked her screaming to her feet again.
"I said stop that," he bellowed.
He pulled her face close to his and breathed a lungful of cheap wine and weak old rancid goat fat fumes at her, which failed to cheer her up because it reminded her sharply of her late lamented husband, who used to do the same thing to her every night. She sobbed.
"Be nice to him,"
the Mongol snarled, and spat one of his unwanted teeth at her.
"Ask him how his work's going."
She gawped at him. The nightmare was continuing. A stinging blow landed on her cheek.
"Just say to him," the soldier snarled again, "how's the work going, dear?"
He shoved her forward.
How's the work going, dear?"
she yelped miserably. The soldier shook her.
"Put some affection into it," he roared.
She sobbed again.
How's the work going, dear?"
she yelped miserably again, but this time with a kind of pathetic pout at the end. The mighty Khan sighed.
"Oh, not too bad, I suppose," he said in a world-weary tone. "We swept through Manchuria a bit and spilt quite a lot of blood there. That was in the morning. Then this afternoon was mainly pillaging, though there was a bit of bloodshed around 4:30. What sort of day have you had?"
So saying, he pulled a couple of scroll maps from out of his furs and started to study them abstractedly by the light of the smouldering dog. The Mongol warrior pulled a glowing poker out of the fire and advanced menacingly on the woman.
"Tell him. Go on."
She leapt back with a shriek.
"Tell him."
My husband and father were killed," she said.
"Yes, dear,"
said Khan absently, not looking up from his maps.
"Dog was burnt."
Oh, really?
Well, that's about it, really.
The soldier advanced on her with the poker again.
"Oh, and I was tortured a bit,"
shrieked the woman. Khan looked up at her.
"What?" he said vaguely. "Sorry, dear. I was just reading this."
"Right," said the soldier. "Nag him."
"What?"
"Just say, 'Look, Genghis, put that thing away while I'm talking to you. Here I am, spend all day slaving over a hot—'
"He'll kill me."
"Bleeding kill you if you don't."
"I can't stand it,"
cried the woman and collapsed on the floor. She flung herself on the great Khan's feet.
"Don't torment me," she wailed. "If you mean to rape me, then rape me, but don't—"
The great Khan surged to his feet and glowered down at her.
"No,"
he muttered savagely. "You'd only laugh. You're just like all the others." He stormed out of the hut and rode off into the night in such a rage that he almost forgot to burn down the village before he left. After another particularly vicious day, the last of the horsemen disappeared into the smoke and the thudding of their hooves receded into the grey distance. The smoke hung on the land. It drifted across the setting sun, which lay like an open wound across the western sky. In the ringing silence that followed the battle, very, very few, pitifully few cries could be heard from the bloody, mangled wreckage on the fields. Ghost-like figures, stunned with horror, emerged from the woods, stumbled and then ran forward, crying. Women searching for their husbands, brothers, fathers, lovers, first amongst the dying and then amongst the dead. Far away, behind the screen of smoke, thousands of horsemen arrived at their sprawling camp, and with a huge amount of clatter, shouting, and comparing of backhand slashes, they dismounted and instantly started in on the cheap wine and rancid goat fat. In front of his splendidly bedraped imperial tent, a blood-stained and battle-weary Khan dismounted.
"Which battle was that?"
he asked his son Ogdai, who had ridden with him. Ogdai was a young and ambitious general, keenly interested in viciousness of all kinds. He was hoping to improve on his own known world record for the highest number of peasants impaled on a single sword thrust, and would be getting in some practice that night. He strode up to his father.
"It was the Battle of Samarkand, O Khan," he proclaimed, and rattled his sword in a tremendously impressive way.
Khan folded his arms and leant on his horse, looking over it across the dreadful mess they'd made of the valley beneath them.
"Oh, I can't tell the difference any more," he said with a sigh. "Did we win?"
"Oh, yes, yes, yes," exclaimed Ogdai with fierce pride. "It was a mighty victory indeed. Indeed it was," he added, and waggled his sword again. He drew it excitedly and made a few practice thrusts. Yes, he thought to himself, tonight he was going to go for the 6.
Khan screwed his face up at the gathering dust.
"Oh, dear," he said. "After 20 years of these 2-hour battles, I get the feeling that there must be more to life, you know."
He turned, lifted up the front of his torn and bloodied gold-embroidered tunic, and stared down at his own hairy tummy.
"Here, feel this," he said. "Do you think I'm putting it on a bit?"
Ogdai gazed at the great Khan's tummy with a mixture of awe and impatience.
No, he said.
No, not at all. With a flick of his fingers, Ogdai summoned a servant to bring the maps to him, ran him through, and as he fell, caught from his nerveless but not entirely surprised fingers the plans of the grand campaign. "Now, O Khan," he said, spreading the map over the back of another servant who stood specially hunched over for the purpose, "we must push forward to Persia, and then we shall be poised to take over the whole world."
"No, look, feel that," said Khan, pinching a fold of skin between his fingers. "Do you think—"
"Khan," interrupted Ogdai urgently, "we are on the point of conquering the world." He stabbed at the map with a knife, catching the servant beneath a nasty nick on his left lung.
"When?" said Khan with a frown.
Ogdai threw up his arms in exasperation.
"Tomorrow," he said. "We start tomorrow."
"Oh, well, tomorrow's a bit difficult, you see," said Khan. He puffed out his cheeks and thought for a moment. "The thing is that next week I've got this lecture on carnage techniques in Bokhara, and I thought I'd use tomorrow to prepare it."
Ogdai stared at him in astonishment as the map-bearing servant slowly collapsed on his foot.
"Well, can't you put that off?" he exclaimed.
"Well, you see, they've paid me quite a lot of money for it already, so I'm a bit committed."
"Well, Wednesday."
Khan pulled a scroll from out of his tunic and looked through it, shaking his head slowly.
"Not sure about Wednesday."
"Thursday?"
"No, Thursday I am certain about. We've got Ogdai and his wife coming round to dinner, and I'd kind of promised—"
"But I am Ogdai."
"Well, there you are, then. You wouldn't be able to make it either."
Ogdai's silence was only disturbed by the sound of thousands of hairy Mongols shouting and fighting and getting pissed.
"Look," he said quietly, "will you be ready to conquer the world on Friday?"
Khan sighed. "Well, the secretary comes in on Friday mornings."
"Does she?"
"All those letters to answer. You'd be astonished at the demands people try to make on my time, you know." He slouched moodily against his horse. "Would I sign this? Would I appear there? Would I please do a sponsored massacre for charity? So that usually takes till at least three. Then I had hoped to get away early for a long weekend. Now, Monday. He consulted his scroll again. "Monday's out, I'm afraid. Rest and recuperation. That's one thing I do insist upon. Now, how about Tuesday?"
The strange keening noise that could be heard in the distance at this moment sounded like the normal everyday wailing of women and children over their slaughtered menfolk, and Khan paid it no mind. A light bobbed on the horizon.
"Tuesday. Look, I'm free in the morning. No, hold on a moment. I'd sort of made a date for meeting this awfully interesting chap who knows absolutely everything about understanding things, which is something I'm awfully bad at. Now that's a pity, because that was my only free day next week. Now, next Tuesday we could usefully think about, or is that the day I—"
The keening sound continued. In fact, it grew, but it was so lightly borne upon the evening breeze that it still did not intrude itself on Khan's senses. The approaching light was so pale as to be indistinguishable from that of the moon, which was bright that night.
"So that's more or less the whole of March out," said Khan, "I'm afraid."
"April?"
asked Ogdai, wearily. He idly whipped out a passing peasant's liver, but the joy had gone out of it. He flipped the thing listlessly off into the dark. A dog, which had grown very fat over the years by the simple expedient of staying close to Ogdai at all times, leapt on it. These were not pleasant times.
"Well, no. April's out," said Khan. "I'm going to Africa in April, and that's one thing I had promised myself."
The light approaching them through the night sky had now at last attracted the attention of one or two other leading Mongols in the vicinity, who, wonderingly, stopped hitting each other and stabbing things, and drew near.
"Look,"
said Ogdai, himself still unaware of what things were coming to pass,
"can we please agree that we will conquer the world in May, then?"
The mighty Khan sucked doubtfully on his teeth.
"Well, I don't like to commit myself that far in advance. One feels so tied down if one's life is completely mapped out beforehand. I should be doing more reading, for heaven's sake. When am I going to find the time for that? Anyway,"
he sighed and scratched at his scroll,
"May, possible conquest of the world. Now, I've only penciled that in, so don't regard it as absolutely definite, but keep on at me about it and we'll see how it goes."
"Hello?
What's that?"
Slowly,
with the grace of a beautiful woman stepping into a bath. A long, slim, silver craft lowered itself gently to the ground. Soft light streamed from it. From its opening doorway stepped a tall, elegant creature with a curiously fine grey-green complexion. It walked slowly towards them. In its path lay the dark figure of a peasant who had been crying quietly to himself since he had watched his liver being eaten by Ogdai's dog, and had known that no way was he going to get it back, and wondering how on earth his poor wife was going to cope now. He chose this moment finally to pass on to better things. The tall alien stepped over him with distaste, and though you would have had to read his face very closely to realize this, a little envy. He nodded briefly to each of the gathered Mongol leaders in turn, and pulled a small clipboard out from under his heavy, metallic robe.
"Good evening," it said in a small, weaselly voice. "My name is Wowbagger, also called the Infinitely Prolonged. I shall not trouble you with the reasons why. Greetings."
He turned and addressed the completely pop-eyed Mighty Khan.
"You are Genghis Khan. Genghis Temujin Khan, son of Yasugai."
The diary scroll slipped from Khan's hands to the ground. The pale luminescence from Wowbagger's ship suffused his wondering, ravaged, careworn yellow features. As in a dream, the mighty emperor stepped forward in acknowledgement.
"Can I just check the spelling?" said the alien, showing him the clipboard. "I would hate to get it wrong at this stage and then have to start all over again. I really would."
Khan nodded faintly.
"Right number of H's, then," said the alien.
Again the transfigured emperor slightly inclined his face, while his eyes still boggled.
"Good,"
said Wowbagger, and made a little tick on his clipboard. He looked up.
"Genghis Khan," he said, "you are a wanker. You are a tosspot. You are a very tiny piece of turd. Thank you."
With that, he retreated into his ship and flew off. There was a nasty kind of silence. Later that year, Genghis Khan stormed into Europe in such a rage that he almost forgot to burn down Asia before he left. From the utterly, utterly merry comic relief, Christmas Book, 1986. Young Zaphod plays it safe. A large flying craft moved swiftly across the surface of an astoundingly beautiful sea. From mid-morning onwards it plied back and forth in great widening arcs, and at last attracted the attention of the local islanders, a peaceful, seafood-loving people who gathered on the beach and squinted up into the blinding sun, trying to see what was there. Any sophisticated, knowledgeable person who had knocked about, seen a few things, would probably have remarked on how much the craft looked like a filing cabinet. A large and recently burgled filing cabinet, lying on its back, with its drawers in the air and flying. The islanders, whose experience was of a different kind, were instead struck by how little it looked like a lobster. They chattered excitedly about its total lack of claws, its stiff, unbendy back, and the fact that it seemed to experience the greatest difficulty staying on the ground. This last feature seemed particularly funny to them. They jumped up and down on the spot a lot to demonstrate to the stupid thing that they themselves found staying on the ground the easiest thing in the world. But soon this entertainment began to pall for them. After all, since it was perfectly clear to them that the thing was not a lobster, and since their world was blessed with an abundance of things that were lobsters, a good half a dozen of which were now marching succulently up the beach towards them, they saw no reason to waste any more time on the thing, but decided instead to adjourn immediately for a late lobster lunch. At that exact moment, the craft stopped suddenly in mid-air, then upended itself and plunged headlong into the ocean with a great crash of spray which sent them shouting into the trees. When they re-emerged, nervously, a few minutes later, all they were able to see was a smoothly scarred circle of water and a few gulping bubbles. "That's odd," they said to each other, between mouthfuls of the best lobster to be had anywhere in the Western Galaxy. "That's the second time that's happened in a year." The craft, which wasn't a lobster, dived direct to a depth of 200 feet and hung there in the heavy blueness while vast masses of water swayed about it. High above, where the water was magically clear, a brilliant formation of fish flashed away. Below, where the light had difficulty reaching, the colour of the water sank to a dark and savage blue. Here, at 200 feet, the sun streamed feebly. A large, silk-skinned sea mammal rolled idly by, inspecting the craft with a kind of half-interest, as if it had half expected to find something of this kind round about here. And then it slid on up and away towards the rippling light. The craft waited here a minute or two, taking readings, and then descended another 200 feet. At this depth it was becoming seriously dark. After a moment or two, the internal lights of the craft shut down, and in the second or so that passed before the main external beam suddenly stabbed out, the only visible light came from a small, hazily illuminated pink sign, which read, "The Beeblebrocks Salvage and Really Wild Stuff Corporation." The huge beams switched downwards, catching a vast shoal of silver fish, which swiveled away in silent panic. In the dim control room, which extended in a broad bow from the craft's blunt prow, four heads were gathered around a computer display that was analyzing the very, very faint and intermittent signals that were emanating from deep on the seabed. "That's it," said the owner of one of the heads, finally.
"Can we be quite sure?" said the owner of another of the heads.
100% positive," replied the owner of the first head.
"You're 100% positive that the ship which is crashed on the bottom of this ocean is the ship which you said you were 100% positive could 100% positively never crash?" said the owner of the two remaining heads. "Hey," he put up two of his hands, "I'm only asking." The two officials from the Safety and Civil Reassurance Administration responded to this with a very cold stare, but the man with the odd, or rather the even, number of heads missed it. He flung himself back on the pilot couch, opened a couple of beers, one for himself, and the other also for himself, stuck his feet on the console and said, "Hey, baby," through the ultra-glass at a passing fish.
"Mr. Beeblebrocks," began the shorter and less reassuring of the two officials, in a low voice.
"Yep," said Zaphod, rapping a suddenly empty can down on some of the more sensitive instruments. "You ready to dive? Let's go."
"Mr. Beeblebrocks, let us make one thing perfectly clear."
"Yeah, let's," said Zaphod. "How about this for a start? Why don't you just tell me what's really on this ship?"
"We have told you," said the official. "Byproducts."
Zaphod exchanged weary glances with himself. "By-products," he said.
"By-products of what?"
"Processes," said the official.
"What processes?"
"Processes that are perfectly safe."
"Santa Zaquana Vustra!" exclaimed both of Zaphod's heads in chorus. "So safe that you have to build a zarking fortress ship to take the by-products to the nearest black hole and tip them in? Only it doesn't get there because the pilot does a detour. Is this right, to pick up some lobster? Okay, so the guy is cool, but, I mean, own up. This is barking time. This is major lunch. This is stool approaching critical mass. This is a total vocabulary failure."
"Shut up,"
his right head yelled at his left. "We're flanging." He got a good calming grip on the remaining beer can. "Listen, guys," he resumed after a moment's peace and contemplation. The two officials had said nothing. Conversation at this level was not something to which they felt they could aspire. "I just want to know," insisted Zaphod, "what you're getting me into here." He stabbed a finger at the intermittent readings trickling over the computer screen. They meant nothing to him, but he didn't like the look of them at all. They were all squiggly, with lots of long numbers and things.
"It's breaking up! Is that it?"
he shouted.
"It's got a hole full of epsilonic radiating aerist rods, or something that'll fry this whole space sector for zillions of years back, and it's breaking up. Is that the story? Is that what we're going down to find? Am I going to come out of that wreck with even more heads?"
"It cannot possibly be a wreck, Mr. Beeblebrocks," insisted the official. "The ship is guaranteed to be perfectly safe. It cannot possibly break up."
"Then why are you so keen to go and look at it?"
"We like to look at things that are perfectly safe."
"Free-yo!"
"Mr. Beeblebrocks," said the official patiently, "may I remind you that you have a job to do?"
"Yeah,"
Well, maybe I don't feel so keen on doing it all of a sudden. What do you think I am, completely without any moral what's-its? What do they call those moral things?
Scruples?
Scruples, thank you. Whatsoever? Well? The two officials waited calmly. They coughed slightly to help pass the time. Zaphod sighed a what-is-the-world-coming-to sort of sigh to absolve himself from all blame, and swung himself around in his seat.
Ship?
He called.
Yup, said the ship.
Do what I do. The ship thought about this for a few milliseconds, and then, after double-checking all the seals on its heavy-duty bulkheads, it began slowly, inexorably, in the hazy blaze of its lights, to sink to the lowest depths. 500 feet. 1,000. 2,000. Here, at a pressure of nearly 70 atmospheres, in the chilling depths where no light reaches, nature keeps its most heated imaginings. 2-foot-long nightmares loomed wildly into the bleaching light, yawned and vanished into the blackness. 2,500 feet. At the dim edges of the ship's lights, guilty secrets flitted by with their eyes on stalks. Gradually, the topography of the distantly approaching ocean bed resolved with greater and greater clarity on the computer displays, until at last a shape could be made out that was separate and distinct from its surroundings. It was like a huge, lopsided cylindrical fortress, which widened sharply halfway along its length to accommodate the heavy ultraplating with which the crucial storage holds were clad, and which were supposed by its builders to have made this the most secure and impregnable spaceship ever built. Before launch, the material structure of this section had been battered, rammed, blasted, and subjected to every assault its builders knew it could withstand, in order to demonstrate that it could withstand them. The tense silence in the cockpit tightened perceptibly as it became clear that it was this section that had broken rather neatly in two.
"In fact, it's perfectly safe," said one of the officials. "It's built so that even if the ship does break up, the storage holds cannot possibly be breached."
3,825 feet. 4 high-presh A smart suits moved slowly out of the open hatchway of the salvage craft and waded through the barrage of its lights towards the monstrous shape that loomed darkly out of the sea night. They moved with a sort of clumsy grace, near weightless, though weighed on by a world of water. With his right-hand head, Zaphod peered up into the black immensities above him, and for a moment his mind sang with a silent roar of horror. He glanced to his left, and was relieved to see that his other head was busy watching the Brockian ultra-cricket broadcasts on the helmet vid without concern. Slightly behind him, to his left, walked the two officials from the Safety and Civil Reassurance Administration. Slightly in front of him, to his right, walked the empty suit, carrying their implements and testing the way for them. They passed the huge rift in the broken-backed Starship billion-year bunker, and played their flashlights up into it. Mangled machinery loomed between torn and twisted bulkheads, 2 feet thick. A family of large, transparent eels lived in there now, and seemed to like it. The empty suit preceded them along the length of the ship's gigantic, murky hull, trying the airlocks. The third one it tested ground open uneasily. They crowded inside it, and waited several long minutes while the pump mechanisms dealt with the hideous pressure that the ocean exerted, and slowly replaced it with an equally hideous pressure of air and inert gases. At last the inner door slid open, and they were admitted to a dark outer holding area of the Starship billion-year bunker. Several more high-security Titan O hold doors had to be passed through, each of which the officials opened with a selection of quark keys. Soon they were so deep within the heavy security fields that the ultra-cricket broadcasts were beginning to fade, and Zaphod had to switch to one of the rock video stations, since there was nowhere that they were not able to reach. A final doorway slid open, and they emerged into a large sepulchral space. Zaphod played his flashlight against the opposite wall, and it fell full on a wild-eyed, screaming face. Zaphod screamed a diminished fifth himself, dropped his light and sat heavily on the floor, or rather on a body which had been lying there undisturbed for around 6 months, and which reacted to being sat on by exploding with great violence. Zaphod wondered what to do about all this, and after a brief but hectic internal debate, decided that passing out would be the very thing. He came to a few minutes later, and pretended not to know who he was, where he was, or how he had got there, but was not able to convince anybody. He then pretended that his memory suddenly returned with a rush, and that the shock caused him to pass out again, but he was helped unwillingly to his feet by the empty suit, which he was beginning to take a serious dislike to, and forced to come to terms with his surroundings. They were dimly and fitfully lit, and unpleasant in a number of respects, the most obvious of which was the colourful arrangement of parts of the ship's late lamented navigation officer over the floor, walls and ceiling, and especially over the lower half of his, Zaphod's, suit. The effect of this was so astoundingly nasty that we shall not be referring to it again at any point in this narrative, other than to record briefly the fact that it caused Zaphod to throw up inside his suit, which he therefore removed and swapped after suitable headgear modifications with the empty one. Unfortunately, the stench of the fetid air in the ship, followed by the sight of his own suit walking around casually draped in rotting intestines, was enough to make him throw up in the other suit as well, which was a problem that he and the suit would simply have to live with. There. All done. No more nastiness. At least, no more of that particular nastiness. The owner of the screaming face had calmed down very slightly now, and was bubbling away incoherently in a large tank of yellow liquid, an emergency suspension tank.
"It was crazy," he babbled. "Crazy. I told him we could always try the lobster on the way back, but he was crazy. Obsessed. Did you ever get like that about lobster? Because I don't. Seems to me it's all rubbery and fiddly to eat and not that much taste. Well, I mean, is there? I infinitely prefer scallops and said so. Oh, Zarquan, I said so."
Zaphod stared at this extraordinary apparition flailing in its tank. The man was attached to all kinds of life support tubes, and his voice was bubbling out of speakers that echoed insanely round the ship, returning as haunting echoes from deep and distant corridors.
"That was where I went wrong," the madman yelled. "I actually said that I preferred scallops, and he said it was because I hadn't had real lobster like they did where his ancestors came from, which was here, and he'd prove it. He said it was no problem. He said the lobster here was worth a whole journey, let alone the small diversion it would take to get here, and he swore he could handle the ship in the atmosphere, but it was madness. Madness!"
He screamed and paused with his eyes rolling, as if the word had rung some kind of bell in his mind.
"The ship went right out of control. I couldn't believe what we were doing. And just to prove a point about lobster, which is really so overrated as a food, I'm sorry to go on about lobsters so much. I'll try and stop in a minute. But they've been on my mind so much for the months I've been in this tank. Can you imagine what it's like to be stuck in a ship with the same guys for months, eating junk food, when all one guy will talk about is lobster, and then spend 6 months floating by yourself in a tank thinking about it? I promise I will try and shut up about the lobsters. I really will. Lobsters, lobsters, lobsters. Enough. I think I'm the only survivor. I'm the only one who managed to get to an emergency tank before we went down. I sent out the Mayday and then we hit. It's a disaster, isn't it? A total disaster. And all because the guy liked lobsters. How much sense am I making? It's really hard for me to tell."
He gazed at them beseechingly, and his mind seemed to sway slowly back down to earth like a falling leaf. He blinked and looked at them oddly, like a monkey peering at a strange fish. He scrabbled curiously with his wrinkled-up fingers at the glass side of the tank. Tiny, thick yellow bubbles loosed themselves from his mouth and nose, caught briefly in his swab of hair and strayed on upwards.
"Oh, Zarquan! Oh, heavens!" he mumbled pathetically to himself. "I've been found! I've been rescued!"
"Well," said one of the officials briskly, "you've been found at least."
He strode over to the main computer bank in the middle of the chamber and started checking quickly through the ship's main monitor circuits for damage reports.
"The aerist rod chambers are intact," he said.
"Holy dingoes, doos!" snarled Zaphod. "There are aerist rods on board!"
Aerist rods were devices used in a now happily abandoned form of energy production. When the hunt for new sources of energy had at one point got particularly frantic, one bright young chap suddenly spotted that one place which had never used up all its available energy was the past. And with the sudden rush of blood to the head that such insights tend to induce, he invented a way of mining it that very same night. And within a year, huge tracts of the past were being drained of all their energy and simply wasting away. Those who claimed that the past should be left unspoilt were accused of indulging in an extremely expensive form of sentimentality. The past provided a very cheap, plentiful and clean source of energy. There could always be a few natural past reserves set up if anyone wanted to pay for their upkeep, and as for the claim that draining the past impoverished the present, well, maybe it did, slightly. But the effects were immeasurable, and you really had to keep a sense of proportion. It was only when it was realized that the present really was being impoverished, and that the reason for it was that those selfish, plundering, wasteful bastards up in the future were doing exactly the same thing, that everyone realized that every single aerist rod and the terrible secret of how they were made would have to be utterly and forever destroyed. They claimed it was for the sake of their grandparents and grandchildren, but it was, of course, for the sake of their grandparents' grandchildren and their grandchildren's grandparents. The official from the Safety and Civil Reassurance Administration gave a dismissive shrug. "They're perfectly safe," he said. He glanced up at Zaphod and suddenly said with uncharacteristic frankness, "There's worse than that on board. At least," he added, tapping at one of the computer screens, "I hope it's on board." The other official rounded on him sharply.
"What the hell do you think you're saying?" he snapped.
The first shrugged again. He said, "It doesn't matter. He can say what he likes. No one would believe him. It's why we chose to use him rather than anything official, isn't it? The more wild the story he tells, the more it'll sound like he's some hippie adventurer making it up. He can even say that we said this, and it'll make him sound like a paranoid." He smiled pleasantly at Zaphod, who was seething in a suit full of sick. "You may accompany us," he told him, "if you wish." "You see," said the official, examining the ultra-titanium outer seals of the aerist rod hold. "Perfectly secure, perfectly safe." He said the same thing as they passed holds containing chemical weapons so powerful that a teaspoonful could fatally infect an entire planet. He said the same thing as they passed holds containing zeta-active compounds so powerful that a teaspoonful could blow up a whole planet. He said the same thing as they passed holds containing theta-active compounds so powerful that a teaspoonful could irradiate a whole planet.
"I'm glad I'm not a planet," muttered Zaphod.
"You'd have nothing to fear," assured the official from the Safety and Civil Reassurance Administration. "Planets are very safe, provided," he added, and paused. They were approaching the hold nearest to the point where the back of the starship billion-year bunker was broken. The corridor here was twisted and deformed, and the floor was damp and sticky in patches.
"Ho hum," he said. "Ho very much hum."
"Oh, what's in this hold?" demanded Zaphod.
"By-products,"
said the official, clamming up again.
"By-products," insisted Zaphod quietly. "Of what?"
Neither official answered. Instead, they examined the hold door very carefully and saw that its seals were twisted apart by the forces that had deformed the whole corridor. One of them touched the door slightly. It swung open to his touch. There was darkness inside, with just a couple of dim yellow lights deep within it.
"Of what?" hissed Zaphod.
The leading official turned to the other.
"There's an escape capsule," he said, "that the crew were to use to abandon ship before jettisoning it into the black hole," he said. "I think it would be good to know that it's still there."
The other official nodded and left without a word. The first official quietly beckoned Zaphod in. The large dim yellow lights glowed about 20 feet from them.
"The reason," he said quietly, "why everything else in this ship is, I maintain, safe, is that no one is really crazy enough to use them. No one. At least, no one that crazy would ever get near them. Anyone that mad or dangerous ring very deep alarm bells. People may be stupid, but they're not that stupid."
"By-products," hissed Zaphod again. He had to hiss in order that his voice shouldn't be heard to tremble. "Of what?"
Designer people.
What?
"The Sirius Cybernetics Corporation were awarded a huge research grant to design and produce synthetic personalities to order. The results were uniformly disastrous. All the people and personalities turned out to be amalgams of characteristics which simply could not coexist in naturally occurring life forms.
Most of them were just poor, pathetic misfits. But some were deeply, deeply dangerous. Dangerous because they didn't ring alarm bells in other people. They could walk through situations the way that ghosts walk through walls, because no one spotted the danger. The most dangerous of all were three identical ones. They were put in this hold to be blasted with this ship right out of this universe. They are not evil. In fact, they are rather simple and charming. But they are the most dangerous creatures that ever lived, because there is nothing they will not do, if allowed, and nothing they will not be allowed to do. Seyfod looked at the dim yellow lights, the two dim yellow lights. As his eyes became accustomed to the light, he saw that the two lights framed a third space where something was broken. Wet, sticky patches gleamed dully on the floor. Seyfod and the official walked cautiously towards the lights. At that moment, four words came crashing into the helmet headsets from the other official.
"The capsule has gone," he said tersely.
"Trace it," snapped Zaphod's companion. "Find exactly where it has gone. We must know where it has gone." Zaphod approached the two remaining tanks. A quick glance showed him that each contained an identical floating body. He examined one more carefully. The body, that of an elderly man, was floating in a thick yellow liquid. The man was kindly looking, with lots of pleasant laugh lines round his face. His hair seemed unnaturally thick and dark for someone of his age, and his right hand seemed continually to be weaving forward and back, up and down, as if shaking hands with an endless succession of unseen ghosts. He smiled genially, babbled and burbled like a half-sleeping baby, and occasionally seemed to rock very slightly with little tremors of laughter, as if he had just told himself a joke he hadn't heard before, or didn't remember properly. Waving, smiling, chortling, with little yellow bubbles beading on his lips, he seemed to inhabit a distant world of simple dreams. Another terse message suddenly came through his helmet headset. The planet towards which the escape capsule had headed had already been identified. It was in Galactic Sector ZZ9 Plural Z Alpha. Seyfod found a small speaker by the tank and turned it on. The man in the yellow liquid babbled gently about a shining city on a hill. He also heard the official from the Safety and Civil Reassurance Administration issue instructions to the effect that the missing escape capsule contained a Reagan, and that the planet in ZZ9 Plural Z Alpha must be made perfectly safe. From the Utterly, Utterly Merry Comic Relief Christmas Book, 1986.